My first journey into fashion was as a young girl. I remember my mother telling me we were driving to Muzaffarnagar, and I insisted on buying neon green Kolhapuris. And she was horrified. She's like, "Who is this 3-year-old who's crying to get neon green Kolhapuris?" My mother was incredibly stylish, and I think she always encouraged it. I saw her dress. I was very specific about what I wanted to wear. And I think we don't realize, but that is our journey with fashion. When we're like, listen, this makes me feel good. This is what I identify with. As we're finding out our identity and who we are using clothing to express ourselves. So that love for fashion always existed. At 16, when I decided I only want to wear black, and it's something that stayed with me till now, I wore only black. I painted the walls of my bedroom black. I put the walls of Pink Floyd everywhere. It was that fashion helped me put a voice to my feelings.
Welcome to the seventh episode of the Ikivi podcast, season 3. Today we are honored to host Nonita Kalra, a luminary with over 3 decades of experience in the media world, spanning roles from the editor of Harper's Bazaar India to the editor-in-chief of Elle India. Throughout her career, Nonita has been an architect of fashion, beauty, and lifestyle trends, not just witnessing but also steering the evolution of these realms with her visionary approach. In this episode, we talk about the dynamic landscape of Indian fashion, discussing its transformation over the years, and the trends that promise to shape its future. Nonita shares with us her insights on the changing perception of Indian fashion on the world stage, the role of fashion media in this transformative era, and the impact of social media and influencer culture on traditional fashion journalism. From personal challenges to memorable moments and the continuous evolution of her motivation, Nonita's journey offers invaluable lessons and inspiration for anyone looking to make their mark in the fashion industry. Join us as we uncover the layers of Indian fashion's past, present, and future through the experiences and vision of one of its most influential figures.
Sometimes I've really gone all over the place with these conversations, and it's become not necessarily about what the person actually does, but who they are really. And I feel like those honest stories is something that I really relate to, and I think our audience does as well. So I like it like that.
You know, I absolutely love this because, you know what I feel? People, there are enough people talking about craft and being sustainability advocates, or what is fashion? I'm obsessed with what fashion means to us in terms of the way we were brought up. So the economics of our upbringing, right? Because we grew up in very different times. The politics of clothing, where craft is a common conversation in our lives. It's not something that's brought from outside. For me, clothing is very, very related to us as people and choice. And that is my big obsession. I think that's why, if you look at me, I never define myself as anything but maybe an editor in chief, because what I've done really my whole life is tell stories of other people. So when you tell me you want to tell the stories of people, I love that, because everything we do is only brought alive by the individual that represents a tiny portion of a larger movement that's happening. So your podcast, for example, it's you as a storyteller, someone who both listens and shares, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I feel like these conversations, we recently had this conversation with somebody who is talking about conscious workplaces and how that's important. So she was talking about her journey from being a toxic boss to being in a conscious environment, or wanting that conscious environment. And now she's become a coach to teach leaders to be conscious about their leadership styles and the workspace that they provide for their employees. So it's such an instead of just talking about conscious leadership as a concept, I think it was so much nicer to hear it because it was her journey and her story. So I totally understand what you mean about telling stories of people, because that's where the value is. So I'd love to start my first question. If you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey so far.
So Navi, the thing that you wake up one day and realize is that you've been working for 30 something years. And I always find that really fascinating because I feel like I've just started out. But I've always been a journalist, a writer. I started at India Today as an intern, moved to Bombay, found myself covering advertising and marketing, then moved to the Indian Express, where we started, color pages and city reporting had just started. So we started the society pages and art pages and film pages. And, sometimes I think we're responsible for page three culture, but it was a great moment. We were out there covering the beat of Bombay as a city. And Bombay is this weird city. It has its own energy, right? It's this whole little sort of pulse in the heart of India that sort of is constantly exploring and including. So it was a great time to do that. And then, I got a call for Elle, and I remember thinking, what do I know about fashion? And I went for my interview, and I remember saying, well, I noticed spelling mistakes in your magazine. And if I was the editor, that's the first thing I would fix. They took a chance on me, and for 20 years, I had the opportunity to be first the editor-in-chief of Elle, and then later Harper's Bazaar. And I discovered that there are two things that happened. A, I love that my life has been steeped in estrogen. Fashion magazines are for women, not because women are the only people that care about fashion, but fashion magazines are actually about women's time to themselves. So that was the lovely thing about acknowledging that. The other thing I loved is that I got to work with the smartest, feistiest, most challenging young women. And they made me better and they made me work harder every day because you know the power of a smart woman. She's terrifying, you know? So, yeah, I've been in this business now for 30 years, most of it in magazines. My true love is print, as dated as that may make me sound, but I love any kind of storytelling. So, right now I'm with e-commerce and we're telling stories through video and digital. And God, I love that too. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing, telling other women's stories largely for 30 something years.
So has the fashion industry always, was it always on your radar before you got into L, or was it just something that kind of came to you and you've grown to love it over the years?
Here's the thing. We all pretend that either we like fashion or we don't care about our clothes. The truth is, we love it. Every person loves it. And so my first journey into fashion was as a young girl. I remember my mother telling me we were driving to Muzaffarnagar and I insisted on buying neon green Kolhapuris. And she was horrified. She's like, who is this 3-year-old who's crying to get neon green Kolhapuris? My mother was incredibly stylish and I think she always encouraged it. I saw her dress. I was very specific about what I wanted to wear. And I think we don't realize, but that is our journey with fashion. When we're like, listen, this makes me feel good. This is what I identify with. As we're finding out our identity and who we are using clothing to express ourselves. So that love for fashion always existed. At 16, when I decided I only want to wear black, and it's something that stayed with me till now, I wore only black. I painted the walls of my bedroom black. I put the walls of Pink Floyd everywhere. It was that fashion helped me put a voice to my feelings or my identity. So fashion was always part of my radar. When I got the job, it was the first fashion magazine in the country, but the first fashion week happened as soon as I got the job. And I think this natural growth together made me feel I can do it. The truth is, fashion pretends to be very intimidating, and that's what some magazines do. But the magazines I worked for said, sit with us. We are your best friends. We want to learn from you. So I guess it suited my personality. It was in sync with what I wanted. And so I don't know if I always wanted to do it, but I think every girl loves fashion. That's what every person would tell me. Look at you, look at how you're dressed, your beautiful turquoise earrings playing off with your beautiful gray shirt. We're all fashion people.
I agree. So you've been in the fashion industry for very long. like you just mentioned, how have you observed the evolution of the fashion industry in India, from when you started to where it is right now? Apart from the obvious, of course, technology and e-commerce playing a role, but the industry itself in terms of what we're producing and what we're providing to the world.
Well, that's a big question. I'm going to first try and address it based on how we saw it at the pages of Elle. It was a much smaller number of people. Okay. It was a much smaller number of people experimenting. There was a fearlessness. And whether you want to call it, they would experiment with drape, whether it was Tarun or with chikankari, whether they were looking at a Western silhouette or an Indian silhouette, everybody hated the word fusion. And I think that that's the wrong word. There was an Indian aesthetic that was being explored, and it was many things. It could be the severity of, something Rajesh Pratap was doing, or the madness of Manish Arora and his control over Indian kitsch. There was a fearlessness in the business, a smaller number in terms of industry size, and I hate talking revenue, so I will not touch upon numbers. I don't see fashion like that. It was a smaller number of people, very fearless, pushing the boundaries, trying to address what is India's role in India and what is India's role around the world. Because at that point, I think what's great about India is we don't want to be quiet. We don't want to be told, sit in a corner, you're an Asian, a developing Asian country. We're like, no, 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 no. We talk loudly. We speak in many languages. Each language is a dialect, and we will make our own punctuation. And that's what fashion was. It was all these fantastic voices. 2003, I think, was Sabya's first show. And I'm talking about, I joined fashion in 2000. So it was a moment of magic and fearlessness, a small number. What Fashion Week has done, and that's when Fashion Week does enter a market, it helps the industry grow. It gives you, season after season. It allows designers to expand their voice. It tells them that there's a seasonality, that business will come. Keep developing your house codes. Keep continuing with what you're doing. We've seen that now for 24 years. What it was and what it is now is, it was a small industry then. It's a huge industry now. At that point, it was experimenting more. Now it's much more commercial, which is always going to happen. So anyone who says it's the death of creativity, that's not true. It's followed the normal course of what a developing country will do. It will push the boundaries. It will be very experimentative in the beginning. And then when it realizes that commerce and money is important, it gets more commercial. Does that kind of answer your question? I think we need to break it into smaller points to address various things. That was a great question, but huge.
No, so the reason why I asked that question is one of the reasons that I've started EKV is for the pure passion of putting contemporary fashion and young fashion designers on the map in internationally, and giving the opportunity for international customers to actually buy from these smaller brands that we have. Yes, now everybody is able to start their own websites, but their visibility and marketing is a lot less. And why I started that is because we have such a large pool of designers that are primarily selling at exhibitions and flea markets and those kind of things, but they're not selling to this international audience where they're craving these kind of products and these kind of brands you see in boutiques internationally. And we're at the same level in terms of quality and what we're able to offer, if not better, right? So I felt like, why are we not there? Why are these brands not able to reach this audience? So my question is, in terms of education and in terms of, the young designers that are out there now, or the large pool of designers, maybe I'm in that space, so I kind of started seeing it only now. But has that always been there? Has that always been a part of the industry, or is the perception, or has the perception only been of the big designers that we've had since, the early 2000s?
You know, there's two things you put in there. One is, why aren't the Indian designers selling abroad, right? Into international markets? And I would say, why should they? I'm really sorry. I've always said this. And maybe it comes from the time that the French came and helped us set up Elle. They said, you will be experts in your market. Learn your market best. We have a billion people. International brands are coming to India to sell to us. What do we get by selling 5 blouses in Paris? 25 blouses, 50 blouses, 200 blouses. I don't know why we're obsessed with an international market. Okay, I never have got it. I'm obsessed with the Indian market. I want to sell to you. I want to sell to your friends. I've never had any, look, it's validation, right? I get more validation from someone like you, someone buying my product in India. The international market, I've never got that. Now, I do get when it's big designer wants to go, because what you're doing is you're going as a cultural ambassador. So when Sabya and Anita and Rahul and Gaurav go, they first built their business in India. And then they went, right? So, and that's always been the format that works for me. You're such a large market. But your second question is about sort of where do the younger designers go? Are there more younger designers now? Where is their voice? Are we seeing more younger designers now? Maybe in 2000, there were, please remember that Tarun and Rohit were established designers. But Manish Arora had just had 2 collections. He was a new designer then.
Mm-hmm.
Rahul Mishra came much later. Nachiket Barve came much later. Everyone is a new designer till they become an established designer.
Yeah.
What you're seeing that's a little bit different is some of those names then have had the staying power to last. Okay, the solid businesses built by Sabya, 2003 was his first collection. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
To world domination in 2024, world domination, you have to say that about Sabya. They've had the sustaining power to, you know, have a brand for 2 decades. There are a lot of new brands right now that feel their brands because they have a D2C format, they're being picked up on e-commerce, they do a couple of shows. You have to survive a decade in fashion before you can even consider yourself a label.
Yeah. Yeah,
but what's amazing is everybody has a voice and they're having the opportunity to express themselves. That's mm-hmm. great. There's mm-hmm. a lot more new voices. And that's because 20 years ago, the industry built itself to be a viable occupation. It set up, you know, systems and processes, whether it's a fashion week or multi-store brands that allow brands to sustain. An entire ecosystem has been set up for young brands to multiply.
I think that probably is the largest differentiating factor from then to now is the ability to sell through multiple channels. And I think that that's something that's allowed people to actually reach more customers. My question to you is about...
I'm just going to give you a tiny history lesson though. When Ensemble launched, it was a multi-brand store, once mm-hmm. I think the first. It gave so many designers the opportunity mm-hmm. to survive, including Tarun.
Mm-hmm.
Who was one of the co-founders. So let's, and then at that year, I think in 1996, when the fashion magazine launched, and fashion magazines launched their one role to grow the retail appetite. Everything comes together to work to make brands thrive.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I'm going slightly off, but like in pertaining to these young brands and the conversations that I've had with them over the past, 7-8 years is about, you know, finding those customers. India is a market where offline is still very important and people like to touch and feel fabrics and actually see the product before they act, you know, place that purchasing decision. What are your thoughts in terms of purchasing power in our country? And for these brands to really thrive, they do need to, you know, reach masses, and the mass is generally slightly lower price points, tier 2 cities. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, of course, there is money in tier 2 cities, but you know what I mean.
You know, so you're right. There's a thing about clothing. You like to touch it, feel it, and wear it. Because let's get real. Sizing is chaotic. One day a Zara size 2 will fit you. The next day the Zara size 2 will not fit you. This is Zara, which has standardized sizing. In India, we don't even have standardized sizing. So of course you want to try clothes. And the return policies are very, very lovely, but very hard for small brands, by the way, if you do online, because returns are not easy for brands to absorb. So yes, they need to have online, I mean, they need to have offline stores. I mean, pop-up culture is so wonderful. You can go all over India with pop-ups, right? You're right, the money is in tier two cities, and so is the fashion. I think, one of the things that I tell brands to do is, yes, before you go to smaller cities, start engaging them by building communities. And if there's a lesson for younger brands, and they actually come with ready-made communities. I love to talk about Jewelry Life, okay, the Jewelry, the brand. There were two young stylists who used to work at Elle, and I had the pleasure of working with both of them. Karuna and Gauri launched their brand so organically. They went to print, I mean, they went and had block work done. They went to source. They shared that process. They built the clothes. They did pop-ups. They sell online. They did more pop-ups. Their community and their tribe helped them grow to a point where they now have a store in Kala Ghoda, right? But they took their time. There are no shortcuts in building brands. You know what? I think that older brands know this, but younger brands are in a hurry because, yes, everything is, at a quicker pace and fast forward, but there are no shortcuts to building a brand. Look at L'Oreal, it's 150 years old.
I
It
think.
takes time.
Yeah, and I feel like the VC culture has kind of made everything so fast-paced. Like you're expected to accelerate
30.
growth.
Yeah, 35% ROI. I keep telling people that the so-called angel investor is the devil in disguise. There's nothing angel about it. And I'm always amused at how they take brands. In 2 years, get rid of the founder, whose heartbeat the brand was, and then bring in a suit or a tech bro who knows nothing about fashion, and then they kill it. But they've got their valuation. And I'm going to get into so much trouble for saying this, but I just don't understand how they're building businesses. And I think maybe the fault is people are not building brands and businesses. They're looking at, getting their payouts and getting rich quick. There's love and patience and heart and blood, sweat, and tears in building a brand. Look at Bobbi Brown. She sold her brand to Estée Lauder at 60 something, launched, Jones Road Beauty, and it is such a huge success. And the communication, there are very few products, and the communication is beautiful. It's inclusive without trying. But she's in it for the long haul. She's not overextending herself. She's building it. And this is Bobbi Brown, the goddess, the legend of beauty. She's taking her time.
What do you feel about the education of, I mean, the fashion schools that we have in India, and is do we have enough in terms of preparation for, the students graduating to kind of come into this world and be able to create freely? I studied at FIT in New York, and I feel like the kind of education and a lot of fashion designers as well have done, like, Parsons and those kind of schools. So what do you feel about the education that we have in India in terms of fashion?
I think we have too many fashion schools. Let me get real about that, and not enough jobs. So, everybody's a stylist. Everyone graduates from college and is a creative director, brand strategist, and fashion director. There are not enough jobs, and there's not enough desire. Firstly, there are too many schools and not enough jobs. Is the education preparing them for real life? I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I've met a lot of people who were graduates from the first batch of NIFT and the second batch, the first batch, I mean, the second batch or the third batch were people like Rajesh and Manish and Namrata Joshipura, legends, right? I suspect that our institutes are perhaps doing their best, but there are too many things that are not equipping young people. But the fact that while school and college protects them, real life is hard. Right? And I'm not even talking about the skills. I think you can be taught the skills, Nivi, but putting them in real life, what was your experience?
At FIT, it was great. I felt like, so I did my bachelor's here in marketing, which was absolute rubbish. Like literally nothing. I feel like the 11th and 12th grade taught me a lot more in terms of actual education as compared to college. College, I was part of this other youth organization. That's what taught me a lot more. So I feel like from that point of view, I feel like our education can be a lot more practical instead of just some theory, just some. I feel like the syllabus itself needs a lot more thought, which I think is lacking. But the syllabus and the education quality that I had at FIT was phenomenal in terms of the opportunity given to be creative and to express your thoughts. I think that in itself was empowering for me. Which I feel is not necessarily there here, where nobody really wants to give you importance or the student importance, thinking that they're just students, they don't know enough. Whereas I feel like every single person has so much more value to add to what is being learned.
I'm going to tiny little bit disagree with you. I know a lot of my colleagues who are teachers now, and what they're teaching their students, I'm actually begging them that can I sit in your classroom? Because the way they put fashion into context of cinema and food and culture, it's the stuff of dreams. But I would say the students choose to show up or not show up. It's a funny thing. So I'm not going to really want to comment on this because the teachers I know are fantastic. If I had that education, I would die, okay? And we do get interns, and there are some great kids, and then there are some below average. And this is a tough one. I think that, maybe like all generations, people, we all, I'm decades older than you. Our education system was different, but we got a lot out of it. When I think about my college years, I'm blown away that I had the privilege of going to such a great college. Someone else takes something different from it. I think what people maybe need to understand is you're going to get from your education what you want to take from it. And I can't make sweeping statements and say someone is letting us down. I just can't do that.
I think we can just talk from our own experiences. That's probably as much as we can say in terms of
Yeah.
instead of generalizing.
Thank you for listening to the Ikibi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikibi.com. That is IKKIVI.com. We are a small, sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode.
So I'd like to talk a little bit more about the fashion media, and how that has evolved over the years. Of course, print was heavy, and magazines is something that we've all kind of grown up with and cherished and really had connections with each issue. And I feel like a lot of us in the fashion industry have had that experience. But so much has changed. In fact, I wanted to, subscribe for magazines for our office just because I was like, there's so much in this that you can't get when there's so much clutter online. So it's evolved. Things have changed. How do you see, the print industry is do you think what's going to happen to the print industry? Not in terms of whether it's going to exist or not, but like how is that going to evolve? Does it also have an online component? Also now with social media, how is all of that kind of feeling for you?
I love what's happened. Most people sort of really crib, but I love it because I love when challengers come and overthrow the emperor. Okay. Print magazines were the emperors, right? Whether you talk about a Vogue or a Harper's Bazaar or an Elle, there was very much only we know how to wear fashion. You know, you need the it coat. We will tell you. You can't sit with us if you don't have the latest shoe. There was a lot of that, you know, and fashion polarized to many people. There was going to be a revolution. The peasants were going to have an uprising and throw off the aristocrats. That's what happened. Print is lovely and print is beautiful, and my heart lies in it. I've said it from the beginning. But with social media came the challenges. With social media came the influencers who said, "Well, I'm sorry, but why are you the only people to talk about fashion? I love clothes. This is how I wear it." And that resonated with more people than fashion magazines. I can tell you that circulations of fashion magazines are a fraction of what your average influencer has in terms of followers. And that's fantastic because I always said the magazine can be sort of the command point. Your influencers are the foot soldiers. As long as the message of fashion goes out to people, that fashion is yours. Own it, define it, take it, do what you want with it. That's what fashion actually is. Fashion ultimately is own your personal style. Fashion is not wearing a brand head to toe. That is not fashion. That's never been fashion. So it's been wonderful, this change and this entire disruption. In all of this, at the moment, print magazines are not having a good moment because they haven't adapted to what next. And they need to do it very, very quickly. I think you don't need an issue every month. I think what you do when you do have an issue needs to almost be like a mag, like a book, like a fashion book that you want, whether you want it once in 3 months, once in 6 months, once a year. That needs to be the content that has to last you a year. If you're going to come out once a year, it better last you a year. If you're going to come out once in 3 months, it better have the importance of a quarterly. It should be contiguous and parallel with the conversations you have in social media. You've got to use social to build community, but include people. Like I said, you know, we need to speak many dialects at the same time. As women, the beauty of women is we can have seven conversations at the same time. We can talk over each other, but we hear everyone in the room. That's what a fashion magazine needs to do. And for me, it's surprising that something this obvious is not being done. The people still put out a cover. There's nothing inside the magazine anymore, that they still are not doing different manic things with social media. But the problem comes from the fact that most magazines are legacy brands. So they have legacy rules to follow. So it's not easy to pivot, right? It's not easy to pivot. I've been inside the system. I know how hard it is. I also know that when things are changing, you try and control as much as you can to keep your guard up, to keep things as same as possible, because it's tough to take a risk, right? With someone else's brand, it's almost not fair. So I think we're ripe for, new brands to come up, for online conversations to happen. This is a moment of great disruption. Could I predict this 20 years ago? No. And I love that I can't predict it. How boring if I could predict it, right? But like you said, print magazines are here forever. I suspect they'll see a huge resurgence in 5 years when people get tired of the noise. But will they come back in the way they used to with the periodicity? No chance. That's the only prediction. Nothing goes back. History repeats itself, but not in identical ways. In similar, but not identical.
What do you feel about niche publications coming up?
Love them to death because now I don't have to read things. You know what? Maybe we're all weird, right? And what social media has taught us, and I wish I had it when I was growing up, is that there's a whole bunch of other strange people just like you with the same interest. I wish I had this reassurance when I was growing up. I felt so lonely being this strange girl who was reading Sartre and Camus at 13 and listening to Pink Floyd in her room with black walls. I felt so alone. And I think I'm acknowledging it now. I wish I'd, and now I find that I was one of many. How reassuring. So I think niche publications are that. You know, we like to think this is our weird set of friends. That's what a niche publication is. They were always doing well, by the way, even when we had Elle and stuff like that. Golfing magazines and yachting magazines did really well. Now, I have no interest in magazines that do well for men. I don't hate men, but I'm interested in women. I'm only interested in women and finding them a voice. So I think magazines will come for women. I just want them to be gentle and with love and with kindness, because just because it's for, say, people with curly hair who like to wear purple when they sleep, doesn't mean that people with straight hair who like to wear pink when they sleep are the enemy. That's all I'm hoping for. I want niche magazines to exist in gentleness and in solidarity with other niche magazines.
Yeah, that acceptance of each other in whatever form we are in. Do
There's
you
a
think
lot of
social,
anger.
yeah, do you think that social media kind of brought this to light, this anger or this kind of aggressive attitude between each other for like pinpointing things out and all of that?
I love social media. Okay. I love the freedom. I love
Yeah.
that you can access each other. I love the connections. But the invisibility of social media has brought out a savagery and a lack of etiquette that is so ugly that it shocks me. I didn't know it lay within us. You know, under the cloak in invisibility, we're just being mean girls. Back in the day, in real life, if you were a mean girl, you were excommunicated. You know, there've always been gangs of mean girls, but nobody wanted to talk to them. Now everybody is, it's almost like you have to have a mean girl in you to be part of this clique of cool kids on social media. They're so unattractive, so pointless, if you ask me. But it's like there's this movement, you know, when you watch someone get cancelled, the sheer audacity and ugliness of that. I'm like, are we feral that we're turning on people who made us judge and jury? And it is this is purely a social media thing, which is sad because the power of social media lies in inclusion and kindness. And for me, social media is reaching a helping hand across anywhere in the world. The power of being able to pull someone up is what excites me. I don't want to put someone down, but again, Nivi, early days, people will learn. I am such an optimist. Right now, we're using it for terrible things. We'll use it for better things. And here is the truth. In a crisis, it has only been the most incredible tool for Gaza, for a natural disaster, for COVID, when you needed blood and oxygen. It has been the most beautiful space. So if there are blips of savagery and ugliness, I write it off.
I do feel like gentleness is something that's so important, and I feel like people need to talk about it more and tell people that, you know, there is this human behind that screen. I feel like that's lacking, and I've heard friends' stories of you know, actually going through suicidal thoughts and mental issues because somebody has said something to them on social media without even thinking. So like, I feel like you kind of just say something and feel like nobody is receiving it, or I don't know how you, how anybody can actually say something that mean and get away with it. So I do feel like, you know, we should be talking about being more gentle with each other because we're all going, we all have our own stories and we're all going through so much. But yeah, that's another segue.
It's an odd, maybe it's an odd one. There's somebody who's really, really popular and she will call out people. And then when people say you're being cruel, she'll be like, yeah, I know I am. I'm a flawed human being. I'm like, guys, just be nice. Be nice to yourself and be nice to everybody. It doesn't make you less interesting. But back to your point.
How, no, how, my next question is about I don't want to get into social media anymore because that can be a topic in itself for a podcast. But I wanted to talk about what experience or how your experience was being in the print industry and what you gained over those years and how has that informed your current role in e-commerce and how is that playing out for you?
Oh my God, I think, okay, everything I am is through print, right? I mean, I started reading very young, so I read a lot, I read a lot. So, you know, being able to be a writer was one of the greatest privileges. So being in a magazine when you can do long form, like you feel like you've touched God. You know, my response to work is like that. I think I loved every Monday. I couldn't wait for the weekend to be over. Print was everything, you know. And I'll tell you, it's really weird. Words for me are visual. I mean, they feel like art. So when we were making newspaper pages or designing something, and I love the production because it's like creating something. So when we'd make the magazine or I'm editing copy, the weird thing, and it's so funny, 2 weeks ago I realized it is a skill. Otherwise, I just used to diminish it. I can spot an error anywhere, whether it's a missing comma, a spelling mistake, a sentence constructed wrong. I edit very quickly. I edit very thoroughly, but it's because I've spent 30 something years with words. I better be good at it. It would be appalling if I was not good at it, right? But the greatest gift is to see words as this visual and to immerse myself in it. And literally, like, I can feel each alphabet. It's a religious experience for me. I know it sounds stupid, but I think as I'm talking, I can tell you that you can feel that it is everything. So what a gift to find yourself immersed in words for 30 years. That's what print taught me, right? I mean, that's how it's informed every decision. When you get deep into the words and the sentences, you become a halfway decent storyteller. And so from being able to do that for magazines and to create these things, you know, I did 150 issues of Elle and some, you know, that 13 years with Elle. So you can imagine 12 issues. 4 years with Bazaar, 10 issues. So that I think it's 40, 44 issues, something like that. That's a lot of issues under your belt. So creating mini books was great. And I think in e-commerce, what I've been able to do, and that's why content is so critical for anybody, brand, e-commerce, person, is we're able to give it a point of view and a personality. Now, why would you go to one e-commerce site or another? Well, discount, reliability. But if an e-commerce site consistently produces stories that resonate with you, it becomes instinct to go there. We all love some websites because they're functional, but the websites that we go back to will be like the Olio story, Jodi, you know, the Line, which talks about jewelry. I consult with the Natural Diamond Council. The way they tell the stories of stones, you're like, oh, I just want to hang out with you. It becomes like your friend. You take an inanimate being and make it animate. And that's what I think my many years has taught me. To translate it across platforms and medium.
I love that. Taking an inanimate being into animate. How beautiful. I love that.
Thank
because
you.
I feel like storytelling and, you know, the kind of brands that we have and the products that we curate, each piece, and also with the sustainable industry, I feel like each piece has so much to tell, right? From how it's made, to who made it, to what it's made of, that story itself can make people hold on to that product longer and cherish that product and style that product in so many different ways.
And isn't that authentic sustainability when you hold on to something forever and ever and ever?
Yeah.
That's sustainability.
Yeah. Do you think you would ever go back into print?
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, because I told you it's not died.
Yeah.
Nothing has died about print. Nothing is dying about social media. Nothing. I want everything to coexist. And honestly, the one kind of print I really want to go back to is to write a book. You know, but this is the problem with imposter syndrome. Sometimes when you have imposter syndrome or suffer from it, you end up being too easy on yourself. By being too hard on yourself, you end up being too easy on yourself. I judge my work the worst. I'm never happy with anything I've written. So I think, oh, well, a book is daunting. That's not true. Maybe I'm being too easy on myself by being this hard.
Yeah, I do resonate with that very much. Do you feel like it's a woman thing? Are we like so hard on ourselves that we end up being so easy on ourselves?
You know, I mean, it's not hard. It's very hard to also go easy on yourself. And I think that I'm being cruel when I say that sometimes when you're too hard on yourself, you end up being too easy on yourself. the term is not easy. I think that we get crippled by it. And we have to acknowledge it. And you know what? When people ask me to review a book, I find it very hard to give anything a negative review because someone else had the discipline to do it. I have the greatest respect for them. Someone else has the discipline to go out and do something that I can't. I can only respect them and hold them in awe. But yeah, imposter syndrome is a female thing because it's taken away from us very easy. You know, I always give this example of me at three. I used to stand like this and be like, what do you mean? You know, and now you will run a home, you will do your work, you will step out and entertain people or do the other part of your life. You'll be a mother, you'll be a daughter. Look, no one congratulates you. A guy cleans up after him in the kitchen and everyone's like, my God, you're so amazing.
My God.
I'm like, I'm not going to tell you the things I've done since 5 a.m. Okay? But if you go downstairs, you can bounce quarters off my bed. And I managed to work out. You know, and we don't congratulate ourselves. And I have a little niece who's 5 years old. And she does something cool and she'll say, shabash. And I'm learning from her. I congratulate myself all the time for the smallest little wins.
Yeah.
If I can, damn it, hold a straightening iron without burning my forehead, I'm very happy. If I can use mascara without stabbing my eye, I am fabulous. Who stops me from congratulating myself? Only me, right?
Yeah.
We have to do this. We have to do this for each other and for ourselves.
I think we should do this for ourselves so much because I feel like we're that same thing of, you know, having, like, for example, my husband took care of my 22-month-old daughter for the first time for one whole night. Otherwise, I've been doing it all this while. And everybody is like, oh my God. That's amazing. He can do it. I'm like, what? I've had sleepless nights for God knows how long. But I think we have to just congratulate ourselves and be our own cheerleaders instead of expecting it from other people because that's not going to happen.
We're starting a movement and it's going to be called Shabash Nivi. We have to congratulate. Literally, I look at little Noor, who's the light of my life, and I think, I hope the world never takes this away from you.
Yeah.
I'll kill anyone who takes this away from her.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Can you share with us any challenging moment or experience that you've had over the years in your career and how you worked through that?
You know, I mean, there are so many, but I guess, and we were talking about bosses, I think learning to be a good boss is maybe the hardest thing to do. And I think women walk into situations more aggressive than they need to be because they're not taught how to be a boss and you have to fight to be heard, right? Especially when you're men reporting to you. And I think I was a really aggressive boss. I'm 5 feet nothing. Okay, so I don't know why I felt I really needed to have personality to own a room. And you're always told that, no, you're tiny, you're tiny. You're like, no. Means nothing. I think I was a really hard boss and I was very brutal and I used to celebrate it, Nivi, until one day I made somebody cry in an edit meeting and she looked at me and she says, you have no right to do this. And I realized, oh, I don't. I really, really don't. And even though our age gap was, you know, no, actually I was a decade older than I should have known, but she was very young and so was I. I think hearing this and learning to work on myself has been my biggest challenge because I think that, again, women don't have mentors. Nobody tells you how to run a business. Nobody tells you how to get along with colleagues who are different. No one tells you how to be a good boss. Mm-hmm. And most of us spend so long at work that that is our home. And so that was the start of a really interesting journey where I've always wanted to nurture people. I've always tried not to let my personal biases come in the way. Sometimes when, you know, sometimes you just don't like someone who works with you. But at that point, it's not personal. You have to be their boss and still nurture them and find the best in them. That's been my biggest challenge. Have I had a hard time otherwise? You know, I don't like to see those as hard times. I like to see where I failed as my hard time.
Yeah.
And how I've learned from that. So it's been a slightly reverse answer.
No, that was great. What does a typical day in your life look like? Exhausting, or do you not want to answer that?
You know what? I'm a very cheerful insomniac, so I wake up hours and hours and hours before I need to. So when I get out of bed at 5 a.m. or 4:30, I've been awake long enough for it to kind of be midday. So
Oh
I'm
my
very
God.
cheerful. I'm super cheerful. I wake up, I don't do anything sensible like meditate or have time to myself. I start work. And then I will, go wake up my dog, who doesn't like to wake up early. Her Highness is fed in bed. I always do a fasted workout. I work out every single day, 7 days a week. It's my meditation. I need to exercise to survive. Then I get back to more work. I do a lot of work, but in between work, I stay active. I'm always moving. I will do calls walking around. I'll do chores. I'll take 10 or 15 minutes off to recenter myself by doing something with my hands. I find the precision of that really calms me down. I'm hyperactive, so most things will not work, but making a perfect bed, centralizing something, dusting something, it calms me down. Okay. At some point, I will go for a walk because I live in London. What's really beautiful is when my brain gets really fried, I will either walk into a park. I love looking at flowers. I love when I'm on the streets to let my mind wander. I literally smell every rose. And sometimes I walk into the V&A and just see one exhibit and walk back because my heart needs that. But my average day is a lot of work, but all work is play. I have a little dog. I'm really positive at most times. But I also end my day early because I get peopled out. So by 8 o'clock, I eat dinner by 6. I don't want to talk to anyone by 8 o'clock. Then I want to read. Then at 8 o'clock, I become literally this woman who just lies in repose in her four-poster bed with a book. And I talk to nobody. So I go from very high activity to literally like being static. It's
So
a really
funny.
boring day. I wish I could tell you my day was more interesting and I, you
That's
know.
very interesting for a day. It's not boring at all.
It's hyperactive, filled with, funny dog moments and little joys. I try and find small joys in everything.
Nice. So lovely. My last question to you as a leader in the industry and in this field, what advice would you like to give aspiring journalists or editors looking to make an impact in the industry?
I was just lecturing someone today. I said the rules of good journalism never change. Never, ever. It's research, research, research. And Google isn't research. So, for anybody who wants to be a journalist, hard work, no shortcuts. Very, very boring, no shortcuts. Incredible integrity, because you're reporting. We all have biases. If you know your bias, how do you counteract it or state it? So you need integrity and the kind of honesty that is not expected from anyone else. When I became an intern at India Today, I remember going to my grandfather's house, my grandparents' house, and my grandfather's a retired army general. And I said, "Oh, I've become an intern at India Today." And he said, "From this day on, the rules are different for you. Your integrity will have to be impeccable." And I said, "Nanaji, I'm just an intern." He says, "From this day on, nothing can ever change." And that for me was the lesson that changed my life. And I guess I would tell young writers and editors that integrity will make you stand out. We all think it's the social media presence or the number of reels you do or how you build your own brand. But I think people see through that. I will never forget talking to, somebody in Hermes, and I said, "How does your brand stay relevant now? It's so expensive, and people want iPhones and they want change. And you all talk about old-fashioned values and craftsmanship." And she said, "Integrity and honesty." And I remember thinking, "Nana ji, you were right." So this is a really weird piece of advice to give people. You have to be true to yourself. Because, Nivi, what made you choose me? I was thinking of all these incredible, talented people. Why would you ask me if you could have this conversation? I don't know what resonated. I hope it's just 30 years of hard work,
Of
because I'm
course.
not shiny, I'm just hardworking, you
Yeah.
know.
But I think that that piece of advice is so valuable, and it's not something that you hear of very often from leaders in different industries, because I feel like in today's day and age with technology and with so much going on, and like you said, people can see through things. So if you're not honest with yourself, if you're not authentic, and if you don't have that integrity, I think one is people are going to see through that, but also to yourself. Like, how are you going to feel good about it? Like, how are you going to enjoy your life? Because you do have one life. If you're just kind of lying yourself through your days, what fun is that?
It's so exhausting to lie because I can't remember,
Yeah.
right? I have such a terrible memory that I'd be the worst liar in the world. I'd be like,
Me
what did I
too.
tell you? What did I tell you? I might as well tell you the truth. You know what I
Yeah.
mean?
Yeah. Lovely. Thank you so much, Nanita, for joining us. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you. I have learned so much from this conversation, and I feel like I have to sit with so many thoughts that I have now. Probably journal and kind of get it out of my system and kind of feel it. But thank you so much for taking the time and spending this time with me today.
Thanks for having me, Nivi. You're such an extraordinary interviewer. You research, you listen, you pull out things from people that they have no need to tell you. But most of all, I think what I love about you is just your passion for what you do. It shines through. It's so beautiful.
How
Thank you.
lovely. Thank you. That means so much to me.